Welcome to the Upland Nation podcast. I'm Scott Linden, your host. Hope you're having a great evening or a great day or a great drive wherever you're headed. We're going to have a great conversation, two-way conversation. Lots of callers waiting to get on the podcast and discuss a number of topics. Looking forward to that. First thing we're going to cover is public access, finding places to hunt. We've got some experts in their field, so to speak, as well as just a bunch of guys like me who are going to share their thoughts. We'll also try a first here. I'm just going to take calls and answer questions. Hopefully, I'll provide the right answers. But whatever I do, I'm doing it off the cuff, and you're invited to participate. Of course, I'll also have a place to hunt in our public access tip, a hunting strategy and dog handling advice, and a whole bunch of other fun stuff, so stick around. First thing I'm going to talk about is apropos of our topic for today. Got a phone call, a frantic phone call from another young member of our training group a while back who just wasn't getting anywhere in terms of finding birds and finding places to find birds. I made a few suggestions and then he went his way and I went my way until Sunday when I can't find Flick, until over the ridge he comes back towards me on a chukar hunting foray with two other dogs in tow and the guy I was talking to that week before. Yeah, we all had a great time, saw a lot of chukars, didn't get very many shots. I don't know what it is about this year or the something in the air or in the water, but they sure are skittish, and these are birds that don't get hunted a lot. That's why I was there, and that's why he was there, too. But anyway, I don't know if you're having the same kind of luck, whether you'd call it bad or good, seeing a lot of birds and not shooting a lot of birds. Better than the opposite, I guess. Flick did give me a great point. 300 yards down a gully that I had to shinny down to find him, and once I got there, trying to get underneath those birds another 50 yards and didn't quite beat them to the punch. Did give them a go-to-hell shot just to remind them that they do face a little bit of a challenge once in a while. Anyway, all right, let's talk about the folks who make this podcast possible. Thank you, Sage and Breaker Mercantile. Hey, they got a new product. You know, I've been telling you over the months that if you sign up for their mailing list, you'll get notified when I do, before everybody else. Sageandbreaker.com is where you go to get your hands on one of their new micro suede gun cleaning chamois. Boy, it has everything you need. It does. It absorbs moisture, but it's also easy to clean and sure beats the old towel or t-shirt, doesn't it? Sageandbreaker.com. And Dog Truck and their TNB dual collar. Remember, you get a discount if you just use the code SLUN10. 10% off on that TNB dual or anything else you buy. Good luck. And yeah, take a look at that Dog Truck TNB dual. Well, here we are. We're talking about public access, finding places to hunt. I posed this question on the Facebook page a while back, got a lot of great suggestions and a whole bunch of folks who wanted to talk more about it, among other things. I figure I'll start. So when I'm looking for places and birds to hunt, I use all the usual sources. I ask a friend. I hope that I've already taken them somewhere, and so there's a little bit of quid pro quo. I also look through my old TV shows and my old radio shows from before that for notes and places that I might have forgotten about. That happens a lot. Also my magazine articles, and I do visit all of them. That's why I write about them, and I try to go back, although this year it's a bigger challenge because my New Year's resolution, if you can call new season resolution, is to not hunt any place I've been to before. So far, I'm doing pretty well. I've only gone back to one spot, and that was because of a television obligation, but everything else I've done both on TV and then for fun has been a new public ground for wild birds. And I'll tell you, There's a lot to be said for that. Maybe in our own way, if you do that too, and I'm sure you do once in a while, feel a little bit like Christopher Columbus. I also poke around on the internet, just like everybody else, see if it prompts any other thoughts. And then I go to my go-to list. At the top of that list, believe it or not, are waterfowl production areas. I got turned on to this a few years ago, actually, in South Dakota, of all places, where some of the areas around Huron, South Dakota, are designated waterfowl production areas, but to a great degree, they're dry ground. What I like most about them is the fact that by the time we get out there hunting with our upland dogs for upland birds, most of the waterfowlers have gone home for the day. And like I said, a lot of the ground in those places is dry. It's also pretty well managed, and there's usually some sort of crop nearby. Now, the crop will probably be on private ground, so it's not like you can go venturing into the cut corn or even the standing corn or anything else. But having it nearby almost always helps. Doubt my logic? Well, I've shot sharptails on WPAs in two different states that were next to corn. Pheasants on another one next to wheat. I never saw another hunter, whether he was wearing camo or blaze orange. Now, if you have a hunting atlas in your state, that's where I would start out. They're marked on the atlas just like all the other publicly accessible grounds. Just bear in mind, of course, that some of those WPAs have sanctuary areas. And don't forget, I've never seen one that does not require a non-toxic shot, even if you're just hunting for upland birds and you're far away from the water. Boy, I can't wait to get back to the one I have in mind for this weekend. In the meanwhile, let's start with the phone calls. And our first caller is Bryce Naylor. Bryce, thanks for being on the podcast. How you doing?
I'm great, Scott. Thanks for having me.
And tell me a little bit about how your hunting season's going so far.
I've been doing a lot of traveling for work, so I haven't gotten out as much as I would like. But I'm from Ohio, and I was able to get a decent amount of hunting done while I was still up there. And then I'll be going back for Christmas tomorrow, staying for a couple weeks, and then also going to try to go over into Iowa for a few days. Be the first time hunting Iowa, so looking forward to it.
Boy, you're in for a good time. I've had nothing but great luck in Iowa the few times I've been there, and I can't wait to get back. Now I'm a little curious. I mean, Ohio never makes it to the list of top bird hunting states. What are you hunting for up there?
There's a quail hunting area, only about 8 or 10 counties thereabouts in the southwestern part of the state. They're the only counties in the state where you're allowed to hunt them, and that's only for basically the month of November. But bob white quail, but they're so sparse there that most people don't shoot many of them. They're just happy to work dogs on them. What I mostly go after in Ohio is up around the center of the state, there's wild pheasant. Of course, not nearly as many as there used to be, but they are there. And this year, actually, the numbers seem to be going back up. For the last several years, it was pretty discouraging. You'd have to work hard, do a lot of hiking just to hope to see a handful. It's looking better this year.
Well, good for you, and good luck when you get back as well. You know, that kind of leads into this whole topic. We've been, you know, on Facebook in particular, but even earlier in the podcast, talking about how you find places to hunt. And, you know, you've just explained at least a couple places, and maybe Iowa's a good perfect, you know, a good way to start with this. How are you finding those places far away that you might want to go hunt? Are you talking to people, or did you read this, or what kind of advice can you offer the rest of us?
Well, this is going to basically sound like a commercial for OnX Maps. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. This started mainly when I actually lived in Idaho, in Boise, last winter. And I don't believe, I certainly didn't use OnX very much prior to that. But I now subscribe to all 50 states every year. And OnX Maps, It's especially people out there in Idaho that they said it's something like $100 for a 1-year subscription. And they said $100 for an app, that sounds expensive. It's an app, sure, but it's an app where you can pull it up, and if you know how to use it properly, especially out there where there's over 1 million acres of public land, it shows you exactly where all this public land is. Out there, none of it's marked. In Ohio, all the public land's marked. None of it is out west, or at least not in Idaho. And it allows you to target these specific areas and go directly there. And I liken it to, if you go to the gym, it's hard enough to go in the first place. It's much easier for me to go if I've already got a workout written down so that I know exactly what I'm going to do when I get there. And on X Maps, not only in Idaho, but when I was driving back across the country and I stopped somewhere in South Dakota, I was able to bring that up and just find a spot really quick in South Dakota that was public to run the dogs for about a half hour. I've found public fields in Idaho, and no, I'm sorry, in Ohio. Well, I've been hunting there for 13, 14 years now, and these fields were 15 minutes away from all the fields that I'd always targeted, and I didn't even know these places were there. So Onyx Maps is worth its weight in gold.
Oh man, is it ever? And I use mine all the time as well. And maybe someday they'll send me money and sponsor this podcast. But
Not.
in the meanwhile, I remember many years ago, I had in my truck with me for that half a day, I had the guy who at the time was running the Bureau of Land Management. If you're from Idaho, you know what they do. They pretty much control all the stuff we like to visit out here in the West. And he was new in his job, and I was was somewhat of a player at Field and Stream magazine at the time. And he said, "What can we do to serve you hunters better?" And I said, "Put more signs up to tell us this is public land that we can trespass on." Onyx beat him to it.
Right.
And boy, am I grateful for it. We do the same thing all the time. And you know, there's various states have a similar app as well. And then the hard copy version is the Hunting Atlas I talked about earlier in the podcast. So, when you're looking for stuff like that, is there anything in particular you ask of your Onyx app before you start on a long distance trip? Do you just go to that state on a map and then just poke around in the city nearby this wherever you're staying?
If I'm going to be going on a trip that's several states away and I don't know anybody that lives there, you would be smart, I would think, to try and find out which part of the state has the best bird numbers. That's usually fairly easy to find. And then once you get there, if you pull up Onyx and you're in that area of the state that's got the best bird numbers, then it's just a matter of, if you don't know anybody there already, you're pretty much scouting from ground zero. You just got to start driving around until you find cover that looks good, find food sources and whatnot, and get out and start walking. For example, one thing that I learned in Idaho in my short term there, and by no means am I an expert at any of this, but of course you go up on the hillsides, the steep hillsides, to find huns and chukars. Everybody knows that. But the at the base of the mountains, the foothills, within a mile or two of where the bottoms of the hills are, the land's still, for the most part, flat. And there were huns in those areas, and then also, of course, some valley quail. But it allowed you to focus on the foothills of the mountains like that if you didn't want to go up into them, if you had somebody with you that wasn't going to be walking hills and so forth. So if there's one thing Onyx does do, it's once you've targeted an area where the bird concentrations are good, like I said earlier, it allows you to find all the public land spots in that area, and then you can scout them from there.
Boy, it sounds familiar. We joke about it, but the third day of a chukar hunt for us is now a quail hunt.
Right.
And the
No,
dogs
I
don't
don't blame you
mind.
there one bit.
Yeah. What kind of dogs you running these days, Bryce?
Short hairs.
Nice. Yeah. How are they
Got a
coping
few
with
short hairs.
Ohio in the wintertime?
They handle it well, long story short. They stay in a kennel out in the yard when I'm not home. It's built for the cold. I keep two of them in the same kennel, but even when I had older dogs, the box and the kennels, insulated. I keep bedding in there. Sometimes I put an electric floor mat under the floorboard, a heated electric mat, and that keeps them warm. But staying outside like that, at least from time to time, helps build up their endurance for when they're going to be out there hunting in the cold.
Yeah, you know, that'd be a good topic for discussion on a podcast as well. We all talk about conditioning our dogs for hot weather, but there's an art to conditioning them for cold weather as well. And I probably ought to bring in some of the sled dog guys I deal with. They'll have advice on something like that. Bryce, great to talk with you. And have the rest of your season. I hope it's good. Be safe and enjoy Iowa. I know I sure do, and I wish I was going with you. Thanks for being on the Upland Nation podcast.
Thank you, Scott.
And speaking of that kind of land access, I just want to put in a plug for some of the lesser known public areas that I've discovered over the years. One of them in particular, State Parks. Now, I know in a lot of places, state parks don't allow hunting, but some do, and some have state forests, for example. But irrigation districts, various counties and special districts. We were hunting at a place owned by the citizens of a four-county area when we were in Kansas about 4 weeks ago. So you never know where you're going to find stuff like that. And then don't forget about conservation groups like Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. They're also doing a good job of acquiring, improving, and then making available to hunters all sorts of smaller pieces of property or adding on to larger pieces. I'll give you a perfect example. I hunted someplace recently. It was all public ground, but in between the public ground and the state highway was 1 square mile of private property with the only road. So somebody grabbed that state property, turned it into part of another state park sort of nearby, and all of a sudden, we had access to hundreds of thousands of other acres. So become a student of maps, become a student of the internet, and see what you can find. I found bobwhites along a lake's edge. I busted pheasants on a federally administered river. And I shot a ringneck in that state park I was telling you about. All right, let's get back to the phones. Our next caller is a good friend and hunting buddy from up in Wisconsin, Mike Zicke. Welcome to the podcast.
Well, appreciate it. Thank you very much. How are you doing, Scott?
Well, it's good to get caught up with you again. And sorry to be so aloof for a while there, but that's another story for another podcast, believe me.
Yeah, well, everybody's busy. You can't... I know how it is, believe me.
Yeah, you do. In fact, the first time we actually met in person was up in a place I won't name by name, but it was in the middle of freaking nowhere. It wasn't even on the map. But we had a great time, and it was a grouse hunt that yielded my first woodcock at the time as well. But you're out there all the time, and you're an old-school kind of student of maps. You actually pull out the good old-fashioned hard-copy plat books once in a while, don't you?
Yeah, I am. Matter of fact, I bought brand-new plat books. I went through my plat books this summer and realized that some of them were 7, 8, 9 years old because they change, they come out every 3 or 4 years.
Sure. And obviously real estate changes hands
exactly.
Fairly regularly. Yeah.
Right. So I found spots on the new plat book that according to the old one, it was private land. The state ended up buying it or acquisitioning it. And I found some spots that was clear cut 3, 4, 5 years ago that should be prime grouse and woodcock country for me and a couple of my close friends. So probably we're too old to chase grouse and woodcock.
Okay, don't give me the exact location or you'll have to kill me afterwards. But you know, you bring up a really good point, and that is, you know, especially for a grouse and a woodcock hunter. But, you know, there's some other birds that would benefit from what I'll call disturbed landscapes of various sorts. You have special requirements. You can't just, you know, look for public property or accessible property. Maybe it's privately owned, but accessible. You got to find some other things on there. How do you figure that out? Where do you find the clear cuts or any other activity like that?
Well, there's a lady in northern Wisconsin that does a mapping system that specifically shows all the clear cuts. And a particular state that you want. And I've got Wisconsin. You can get basically all the grouse states have got them. All you can do is call her and say, you know, I want Michigan or I want Wisconsin. You download it on your phone, your iPad, your laptop, whatever you want, and it will show you. You zoom in on your state, and it will show you the clear cuts and what age group they are. Another that I've used last year is Onyx Map Hunt.
Yeah.
And I found a spot that I was on my way home. A couple of my partners couldn't go. It was a nice weekend. I thought, you know what? I'm going to take a couple of my old dogs. Matter of fact, you hunted with my little black and white years ago. It wasn't that old back then, but I took her and my older female, and we went on a hunt by ourselves, which 99% of the time I have a much better time with me and the dog than with a group of guys, but that's a different story and a different podcast. But we were coming home, I had the Onyx Map Hunt opened, and I was at a stoplight and looked down, and I'm like, I don't know what that is. So I pulled over, opened up the map, opened up a plat book, and on our way home, basically drove to about 4,000 acres of clear-cut county land that I never knew about that I'll be pounding next fall for woodcock.
Nice.
You know, a lot of the guys, I drive around, you know, my plat books are down in the basement now because, you know, we've got 3 feet of snow in spots. So most of our couple of guys still go out. I mean, it's going to be in the 30s this weekend. I might try and take, as you know, I have short hairs, but I added a new dog to the pack. I got a 7-month-old English Cocker. And I might take her out this weekend. But come August, I pull out every plat book of counties that I hunt, and on a weekend when Jenny and her mom were gone, I sit on the deck outside with a cup of coffee, and I'm looking at where I want to go, where I want to find, and come August, I'll start driving county back roads, looking at cover. Some of my plat books look like a 3-year-old has been coloring in them, but I've got cover type, age type, how far from A to B, how many birds we've moved. You know, I got guys that will look at it like, oh, make me a copy of that. I'm like, yeah, that ain't going to happen.
I love it.
Yeah. You know, it's just like, and, you know, I mean, Wisconsin, we don't have some sharp tail hunting if we have a draw season. I mean, we have some pheasant hunting. A lot of it's put and take, but in my counties, it's all wild birds because of all the work Pheasant Forever has done. So, but, you know, they get pounded really hard, and I've got grouse hunting. I've got grouse on my property. I mean, I've got grouse hunting from a half hour to my house to where you and I hooked up a couple years ago. It was about 1 hour and 10 minutes. That I've got thousands of acres that if there's a truck there, I can drive 10, 15 minutes and have the same amount of land all to myself.
You know, that's a good point, Mike. I've written about this, but I've never talked about it on the Upland Nation podcast. And that is, have a plan B of one sort or another, because there could well be somebody else out there. And whether you want to share the field with them or not is up to you. But if you're looking for that solitary experience, maybe the other side of the same area or a nearby one. When I'm in the big pheasant states, I'll only go to a place if there's 3 or 4 other places around it so that I can go to them if I need to.
Right, exactly. You know, like for where we were, I would pheasant hunt. It's funny, on the opening weekend, the guys will be parked there at 7 in the morning.
Yeah, yeah.
And even though the season doesn't open till 9, and it's like, I just look at them and laugh. I'm like, you know what? I'll call a buddy of mine. Well, I'm going pheasant hunting. I said, well, have fun with that. I'm going up north.
Yeah.
And I'll have. And it gets busier. I mean, there's certain spots that I've seen guys from, you know, Kentucky and Alabama and Tennessee and the areas that I find, which, you know, it's nice to see that the other people from other states are utilizing what we have. I mean, they're like, you don't know how lucky it is. And, you know, like we talked earlier, I ran into Dave Carty, which I don't know if a lot of people know, but he writes a lot of articles, writes a lot of books, Pointing Dog Journal, Gun Dog. And I was hunting by myself one Saturday. Gentleman walked down the trail, and I looked up, and it was Dave Carty. And we sat and talked, and he's been coming to that area for 13 years.
From far away. He's a Montana boy, yeah.
He's from Montana, exactly. So, I'm like, you know, so it, the area is being utilized. We had a DNR finally come up with the help of the Rough Grouse Society, a rough grouse plan for the state. And they have been cutting furiously the past couple of months. I mean, some spots that I used to hunt are gone. I mean, they just came in there. There's one area, a little south of where you and I hunted years ago, that's completely gone. That's about a mile of all older aspen. They came in, and it looked like a bomb went off. But in 3, 4, 5 years, it'll be crawling with woodcock.
There you go.
So,
yeah.
You know, it's nice to see that they're starting to put the plan together. You know, Wisconsin has got to push the, you know, South Dakota's got pheasants and sharptail and chickens, and Wisconsin has got to push and protect and cultivate what we have. I've been to Park Falls once in my lifetime. It's about 2 hours from my house. I don't need to go up to Park Falls. I've got covered just as good.
Which,
but out of a,
for the benefit of some Upland Nation listeners who don't know Park Falls, they tout themselves as the rough grouse capital of the world.
Right. We a puppy owner of mine called me and said, "Let's do Park Falls." And I'm like, "All right, fine." We went up there, sat in a McDonald's for breakfast before we hunted, and ran into a group of gentlemen. I think there were 10 in the group that have been coming up there for 30 years. And they're retired now, and they do 2 weeks in September, 2 weeks in October, and then they hit Kansas and Nebraska for pheasant hunting. And they're like, you know, they asked us, "Well, how often do you come up there?" I said, "This is my first time ever." I said, "I don't have to come up this far." He said, you don't know how lucky you guys have got it. And I said, "Yeah, we do." I said, "A lot of guys take it for granted, but, you know, I'm a lifetime Rough Grouse member. My dad, you know, put that belief in us that, you know, you had to join an organization, you had to help out." And I mean, I belong to Rough Grouse, I belong to Woodcock, I belong to Quail Forever, I belong to Pheasant Forever. You know, and without these organizations, we're not going to have the bird hunting that we have.
No doubt about it. And I've alluded to how they're actually opening up more area for us to hunt, as well as doing all the other things they're doing. And we should be grateful for that. And for the whole idea of what I'll loosely call economic development by hunters. And
right.
you know, you can cringe at that, but you know, if you look at the numbers, it's got to be done. If we're not out there spending money and using these places, then they're not going to be there in years to come.
You know, I mean, I saw more out of state hunters in the area that I hunted this year, and I'm not talking Minnesota. I mean, I'm talking, well, Dave Carty from Montana. I ran into another gentleman from Ohio. There was another gentleman from Louisiana there. I mean, they're from all over. You know, and where I hunt, it's south of Superior, which is the biggest town near there. There's, it's not the bustling hubbub of the state. It's strictly a bird hunting area. And not, you know, it's a big bear hunting area. There are a lot of bear hunters up there, which we're all glad to see, because they, you know, they keep the bear busy and keep them away from us. But I pulled into a restaurant up there, and there was 11 trucks, and there were, I was the only one from Wisconsin up there that day.
Oh, I've been to other places in other states that have the same problem, but they are hunters and it is public ground, and
Oh,
that's
no,
why we do it.
I'm glad to see it. You know, it's because then you can, you know, sometimes locals don't appreciate it, where these guys have driven a day or 2 days, and, you know, and they're running, you know, they might be from Kentucky that have browsed that they, you know, they might see 10 or 15 in a year, where when you hunted, I think we've seen 19 grouse and 37 woodcock,
Don't make me jealous.
you know, and that was a bad day because the wind was howling 30 miles an hour. But, you know, we, you know, and I don't hunt private land. I mean, it's strictly state, county, or federal land. I've got every county I hunt in, I've got a plat book. A lot of the gas stations will have a county map, and they'll show all the wildlife areas and all the county land. And I'll spend time on my laptop with my clear cut chip and circle areas I want to drive. And I mean, I've thrown maps away that the cover is too old or it's not what I need. And I've found new areas that, like I said, we will be hunting long into we won't either have dogs or we won't be able to follow dogs anymore.
And there you have it. Your assignment is to go do some homework, pull up some maps, however you pull them up, hard copy, digital, or otherwise, and do as Mike does. Mike, great to talk with you on the Upland Nation podcast. Thanks for your suggestions.
Thanks, Scott. Good to talk to you again.
Oh, and we're just getting warmed up. We got lots more, got some more callers on the line. Yeah, the second half of the podcast will be all about kind of stump the host questions, folks who have, well, I hope sincere questions that I might be able to offer a little advice with. Everything from how to improve a small acreage to how to get a short hair to go into cattails to find birds. You name it, it's coming up on the Upland Nation podcast. So don't go away. We also have our Handle It segment, which is all about taking care of your dog after the hunt. And one thing that I seem to have to be reminded of every season. So it's all coming up right here, right after a quick break, where we thank again our friends at ESPAmerica.com. They make the highest quality digital hearing protection devices. And I know. You put them in your ear, and for a little while, you feel like a geezer because that's who usually needs them. But the reason they need something that looks like this is because they didn't have exactly what ESPAmerica.com can offer you, a way to prevent hearing loss. Do me a favor, make your New Year's resolution to keep your hearing intact. Don't forget at ESPAmerica.com, custom fitting. Right in your own hometown. Don't have to sit on the bench, sit on the stool at the sports show and be the sideshow. And everything comes with a money back 30-day guarantee. It's all at ESPAmerica.com. Yeah, so welcome to the Handle It segment. This is where I learn the hard way so you don't have to. Flick is an unbelievable dog. Held a 15-minute point for me in the mud last weekend. When we got back to the truck, the first thing I did after I put the gun away and watered him was put him up on the tailgate. Knowing full well that if I didn't get at that mud between his toes and all over his pads, that it would harden into a really tough challenge of a removal project. And I'll tell you a little tip about how to do that in a minute. But the whole idea of putting your dog up on the tailgate right after the hunt has so many benefits going for it. Check their eyes, check their nose, check their ears. There might be a stray porcupine quill or worse. You can find cuts and abrasions. Like I said, anything between the toes, between the pads. You can find a cut pad. All of that comes when the dog is a little bit off the ground and at your eye level. You'll work a little bit harder at it because it's a little bit more convenient. Now, if, like me, you've actually had a dog who had mud between his toes and it had hardened by the time you figured it out, teach your dog to stand still in the bathtub or something like a bathtub. Maybe you have one of those little kiddie pools. 5 or 10 minutes of that, and most of the mud will have softened up to the point where a little swishing around and maybe a little work with your hands, all that mud is now just silt again, resting on the bottom of the bathtub. So there's one that I've used way too often in recent months. Hope you don't have to, but it starts on the tailgate. And before we get to our last segment of the show with calls about all sorts of interesting things, a couple of emails and a couple of Facebook questions as well, one last plug for more publicly accessible land, in this case from the feds, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service of all things. Well, the state has a few of them as well, waterfowl refuges. I mentioned waterfowl production areas earlier, but I'm talking about the real bona fide refuges that you see on the map. A lot of them, yes, have duck hunting, goose hunting, that sort of thing, but some of them also have upland land hunting, and I have one in particular I'm thinking of where I've shot valley quail, I've shot pheasants, and then I've past shot a couple mallards over the years. Same as so many others, non-toxic shot is required for everything, so it's a little bit more spendy, but how many shots are you going to take? Come on, it's worth the walk. It's worth a couple bucks in ammo. Check that out as well. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Waterfowl Refuges. Good luck to you, and enjoy yourself. Now let's get back to the phones. So here we are. This is going to be fun. I put out the call, if you will, put out the notice that I would try and answer any questions I could about almost any subject, kind of like on my TV show where you send me a question, I make up an answer. With any luck, it'll be helpful. And our first caller on that regard is Scott Mendenhall. Scott, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you.
Tell me, how's your season going so far?
Not too bad. Bird numbers are down from what they have been, but you go to the right place, there's still pockets of them.
Yeah, you know, it's you sound like an optimistic half full glass kind of guy. Are you really seeing dramatic changes from year to year, or is this a kind of a gradual thing?
It had been going up pretty well for the last several years, and then we had a pretty tough winter last year. And it's been more of a dramatic
wow
change this year from what it was last year.
And just
everything was definitely trending the right way, and the weather really wreaked havoc in a wet spring.
I'm not recognizing your area code, so tell us all what state you're in that's having this challenge.
I am in Southeast Iowa.
Southeast Iowa. Had an earlier caller headed for Iowa. I don't know what part, but I hope it's not Southeast Iowa. are you seeing it across the region? Or here's what we see, especially with chukar hunting. One drainage will have no birds one year for any reason, and then the next year it'll be full of birds. And I just had that experience not a week ago somewhere. Do you see that more localized thing happening?
There's farms that we hunt year after year, and it really depends on the habitat and food and cover and shelter and everything else, and places where was starting to get birds has really dropped off, and places that have everything they need, it's dropped off, but not near as drastic. There's still pockets of quail and pheasants in a lot of areas, but it's just not quite as widespread as it was in previous years.
Okay, well, we'll get to your questions from our earlier conversation on Facebook in a moment, but since we're talking about it, and now there's another coincidence involved in the state that you're living in. When you're looking for new places to hunt, whether they're private or public, what's your go-to strategy?
Do I know who owns the farm? that helps quite a bit. But usually it's cover. If there's food and cover, that's what I am looking for. CRP is great. Some of the newer CRP is really good. The older stuff is not so much.
Overgrown.
It turns into broom grass.
And
8-inch high broom grass doesn't make great cover for much of anything.
Well, wait till it's 8 feet high like it was the week before last for me.
Yeah.
Okay, so here we are, and I asked you to ask me a question, and the first question that popped into your mind was about improving habitat on a small acreage. Are we still on the same page there?
Yes, we are.
Great. And do you have a particular reason for this? Are you working on your own place?
No, but I have several people that I have permission to hunt on, and I have permission to kind of do as I see fit to improve habitat. And so these farms range from anywhere from 10, 20 acres all the way up to maybe 140, 180.
Mm-hmm.
So there's kind of a wide array of what they are, and some are crop ground, some are CRP. So there's quite a difference in what's out there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, clearly I'm not a biologist or I'd be getting paid a lot more, but I've seen a lot of stuff. And in fact, I'm thinking about a place I was on not a week ago that it was a cattle ranch of all things. And that was Flick's first encounter with a real prize winning bull, but that's a story for another time. But it made me start thinking about, you know, all of this a little bit more. And then your Facebook request came in and I thought it was interesting. Have you done anything at all yet on any of these places?
I have not, other than kind of try to get them to leave some on the crop ground, try to get them to leave a little bit.
Yeah. Set the combine a little higher or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe not push the fence rail out and leave some cover next to it, but
you know, okay, well, so that we're starting from scratch, and here are the things that I've seen that have worked and may or may not work depending on all the other factors we can't possibly get into without boring everybody else to the point of stiff.
Mm-hmm.
The edges, as you well know, are critical, and you mentioned fence rows, but even on the other side, if there's a way to enhance an edge between a crop ground and whatever is next door, whether it's the road or it's a different kind of maybe timber or something like that, if you can feather that edge somehow, that seems to make a lot of difference, because the birds then are somewhat protected from predators, but they're closer to their food crops as well. For your hunting benefit, the thing that I've seen that works best is, you know, cutting paths and cutting holes in the crops, but a lot of guys aren't going to do that, of course.
Yeah.
The other thing that I would suggest, that virtually everywhere, and especially out in your country, I'll bet there's a Pheasants Forever biologist within a stone's throw of you. And I would get on the horn with that person and have them take a look at it. Now, eventually it's going to cost money, but I think I think they're willing to take a look at a place for free and give you the best advice they can give you based on not only that piece of ground, but what's near that piece of ground. You know, out in the West, our biggest challenge is water. Not necessarily for pheasants, although I've had that discussion with a couple biologists too, but for all those other species we like to hunt, if you can do something to enhance the availability of water, that might be worth a look, especially if you're looking at quail down your way. So those are things that might be worth a look of one sort or another. You have any sway over the crops that they will plant?
Not so much, but with a lot of the CRP, they're having to reseed it and put in cover crops, which, one friend of mine, I talked into putting in soybeans as a cover crop for the new seeding last year. One of the new seedings this year, they did sorghum.
Yeah.
And it's actually turned into a really good quail spot, which there's not a lot of quail down here. There was, but now there's just a couple pockets of them in different spots. But
so they're overseeding their CRP with beans or sorghum?
Yes, they're having they're having to drill new CRP seeding, and then they're having to put in a cover crop with it to protect the seeding for the first year.
Nice. So
those beans or the sorghum are there for a year, and then they die out, and then by then the seeding's established itself. But
well, I've been talking a lot earlier in the podcast about this disturbances of various sorts. One that the folks at Pheasants Forever like a lot, especially the Quail Forever side of the business over there, is fire. And and I don't quite know what you can do with CRP ground in terms of fire and management and that sort of thing, but you know, yeah, I could see some real benefit to that, and then coming in and laying down those beans or that sorghum. And and you're right, sorghum, I've seen that in five different states. You plant that correctly, and not only is it a great feed, it is a hell of a cover crop because it'll stand up to most snow.
Oh, yeah.
So it's good luck on that. The other thing that a lot of folks will do is they'll do a little bit of light disking along the edges of some of this stuff. But boy, if you could just get them to make that fence row 10 feet wider, you know, there's programs out there now. I think they call them some sort of a buffer thing. And I think it's part of the CREP program, which is related to CRP, where if you got 30 feet of buffer, they'll pay you. And again, the key to this stuff is talk to the biologists who are all over these things. And then you manage that as not only just a buffer between crop and whatever's next, but also as real bona fide habitat. And you can do a lot in 30 feet.
Oh, yeah.
So those are some thoughts based on what I've seen other places. Every spot is different. It might be different on the north side of the place than the south side of the place, but good luck on that, and more power to you. You know, it's going to be in the hands of private enterprise to a great degree sometimes, and it sounds like you're ready to, you know, pick up the shovel and do the job.
I try.
All right. Well, keep up the good work, and thanks for being on the Upland Nation podcast.
All righty. Thank you.
And here I got an emailed question from Steve Sorensen a while back, and I finally have the chance to answer it on this great second half of the Upland Nation podcast, where I'm taking your calls, taking your emails, even a Facebook comment or two that's turned into something I might be able to try and answer. Steve asked about getting his short hair to go into the cattails to find birds like his old short hair used to do. Well, I'll tell you know, turning a dog into a birdie dog can be a challenge sometimes, and maybe that's where you need to start. Maybe the dog is intimidated by the thickness of the cattails. It's pretty rough cover, and that's why they breed 100-pound Labradors in South Dakota. But if you do want your short hair to do that, maybe he needs to understand that there will be birds in there if he's willing to go in there. Now, once he's in there, of course, then you got the challenge of whether he's going to point and you won't be able to find him or not, but that's a subject for another day. Getting him to go in there first might start with some retraining, off-season training, where you actually take your dog to similar habitats and show him a practice bird that you then put in there, and he understands that, oh, okay, 2 + 2 equals bird in the air equals a retrieve for me. So train your dog. We do this a lot with the duck search in the NAVDA testing program. The first few times you want your dog to go into the thick stuff that's also submerged, make sure he knows there's a bird out there so he's got some motivation. Scott, Steve, good luck with that, and be safe. Maybe put a bell on that dog before you send him into the thick stuff. All right, let's get back to the phones and another kind of stump the host question. All right, Perry Tomlin calling us from, where is that? 443.
Logan, Ohio.
Oh, my goodness. This is an Ohio-themed show. And by the way,
very good.
I was born there, so I forgot to mention that earlier. But anyway, welcome to the show, fellow Buckeye. And when I put out the call for asking me questions, you had one that I love to talk about. Why don't you start with the first half of your question?
Okay, if I have a grandson who's 8 and I want to get him into shooting a shotgun, but obviously he can't use the 12 gauges that I use, what do you recommend? Single shot, 410, 28 gauge, different gauges and actions for introducing a youngster into the shotgun sports. And conversely, my wife has also taken some interest in, shooting some clay pigeons and things like that, getting an older woman into the sports.
You know, the questions could be answered separately or together, and I'm going to start by answering them together. Because I've helped a lot about this. I'm not a shooting instructor or anything like that, but when nobody else is willing to help, I'm almost always willing to pitch in one way or another, even if I don't know anything. But what I do know is the critical factor with a beginner of any sort is immediate gratification. So you want that gun to fit as well as it can fit within reason. We're not talking about going to, one of the bespoke makers in London and having it custom fitted for them. But, make sure the stock is not too long for either the youngster or the wife. Oftentimes, a lot of these companies are now making sets so that a kid or anybody else could grow into it. You buy a youth stock, if you will, about 13 and a half inches length of pull. Then you also get in the same box, a standard 14 and a quarter, 14 and a half inch length of pull stock that you can swap out later when they grow up. Maybe for somebody like a wife, you never have to swap it out. You may also be able to have a gun that you already own that you don't mind sacrificing in one way or another, that you can have the stock cut down a little bit if everything else works out okay. So gun fit, number one. Then you ask about gauges and that sort of thing. And here's what I'll tell you about that. I think that's important to a degree. And yes, a 12 gauge for a beginner is probably not a good idea. But no matter what gauge you use and what loads you use in that gun, more important is the perception of recoil. And then actual recoil on top of that. And you can fix the perception of recoil with excellent hearing protection. And in a beginner, maybe it's plugs and muffs, but somehow make sure that they are never, ever exposed to that blast without great hearing protection. That will go a long way toward reducing felt recoil, if you want. And then it will also save them from all of the flinching that happens quite often because of those loud shotgun shots. That a good start for you so far, Perry?
That is a great start. And I hadn't thought about the hearing protection. We use it, obviously, but I hadn't thought about how that would affect the recoil or the flinching part of it.
Yeah, it's, I saw some data a while back, and I can't remember where I saw it, but it just made so much sense that most of the recoil we think about is not recoil at all. It's the blast. So like I said, maybe even double up on that, plugs and muffs for a while. Once you get into birds, of course, nobody cares because of the adrenaline rush, but you got to get there first. As far as gauges and types of guns, I do have one recommendation, and that is not a single shot break open gun that you can get for $149 from so many manufacturers. The recoil on that particular engineering just strikes me as way too much for a kid in particular. it just, because of the lightness of the gun itself, and everybody knows, well, if I'm going to, you know, shoot a lighter gun because I'm in the woodcock woods, then they got to lighten up their load. So go with the lightest load you can get. And if you can, a heavy gun. You know, if you're just learning, you're not going to be carrying it for very long in the field. So the gun can be a little heavier than we might think. You know, obviously, you want reduced recoil, you're going to go with a semi-automatic. And you can get some great guns for not very much money in that regard. You might just want to borrow one or two for a while and see if any of this sticks with your beginners. If you have somebody who can lend you a gun that might fit. A lot of those semis also come with removable stocks that you can, maybe you just invest in a smaller stock for a while. And then if you're ready to go, you buy the same kind of gun and you got the smaller stock for a while after they're convinced they want to pursue it again down the road. So those are some of the things that I've seen happen with beginners over the years. So you want to use a light load, you want to use a heavy-ish gun, and you want to make sure that the hearing is protected in as many ways as possible. I'm going to add one more thing to this. If somebody has not ever shot a shotgun before and you're ready to go out to the range and show them how it works in hopes that you're going to get them excited, the first thing I'd do is I'd put a clay target on something, an old stump, a hay bale is what we use all the time. Put it on there and just leave it there and have the first shot at 20 yards so that they break the first target they shoot at. Then after that, it's all about straightaways for a while until they get the idea and learn how to mount their gun safely. Then you can start doing the crossers. So there's my 2 cents worth on that.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate all your help.
You're welcome. Good luck, and especially good luck bringing along two new hunters. I hope that works out well. Keep us posted on how it goes.
I will do that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for being on the Upland Nation podcast.
All right. Bye.
All right, and we got time for one more call. Mark Van Tilburg is calling me. Where are you today, Mark?
I live in Crestwood, Kentucky, just east of Louisville, Kentucky.
Okay, yes. And some great apple pie comes out of there, if you know what I mean.
Yes, we better not go into that in great detail at this point.
Yeah, if we did, we'd have to kill somebody.
Yes.
But thank you. So you're a Flushing Dog kind of guy, and I appreciate that. And just for the record, everybody, yes, I have wire hairs most of the time, but I hunt with a lot of Flushing Dogs of various breeds, and I love them all. I just love the fuzzy face guys slightly more. So, Mark, you want to talk about Flushing Dogs, hand signals, or gun range? Okay. Do you want to start with that?
Whatever. You know, with Flushing Dogs, and I'm a lab guy, and, you know, these dogs love to hunt, and it's real easy for an untrained dog just to go hunting on their own and chase every bird within 500 yards. But that's not what we want them to do. We want them to stay within that 20 to 40 yard range, quartering.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we, as we have talked before, that getting the dog to hunt for you instead of the dog just getting to hunt is the trick with flushers.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And yes, I know the problem extremely well.
And it's a little more difficult. And you and I have visited quite a little bit between pen-raised birds and wild birds in South Dakota.
Yeah.
But yes, you know, those little running son of a guns. And they love to run.
Well, and let's talk about that range thing, because I do have some thoughts on that. And I see another caller we'll have to get to at another time about range and pointing dogs, which that's another kettle of fish. But, you know, the Spaniel guys, the pro Spaniel trainers have figured this all out, and there's no reason in the world it is not applicable to a Labrador or a Golden Retriever or a Labradoodle, for that matter, if you want a flushing dog that wants to stay within what we call gun range, first thing you got to do is define that. And one thing I don't think a lot of people think about is, okay, so if the dog's at 20, 25 yards, that's a good comfortable gun range for me, but that means I have to shoot the bird the moment it gets in the air. So maybe gun range is 15 to 25 yards so that when the bird gets up, I have a half a second or a second to mount the gun. He's at 35 or 40 yards. That's about reasonable. But anyway, whatever you decide it is, here's one way you might want to do this. It'll require some training birds and maybe a couple friends, but it will show the dog that the birds are within that range. And of course, that's what they're going to remember is, let's see, where am I finding birds? I probably ought to stay within that kind of quadrant, whatever it is. The easiest way to do that is the spaniel trainer's trick, where you have you and the dog in the middle of a field, and then on both sides you have a helper with a bag full of birds. They get out a few yards ahead of you, and you all walk in a straight line. The dog is working to the left. When he's working to the left, your helper on the right throws a bird down onto the ground ahead of that dog, so the next time he quarters back in that direction, he finds a bird right in the comfort zone for you and him. And by then, you're either letting that bird fly or you're shooting that bird, and then he comes back and he's working to the left, because by then your helper on the left has put another bird in that same zone. So you go down the field in tandem, if you will, the dog discovering the whole time that there are birds within this close area, whatever you call gun range. And it seems to work for a lot of guys. I just talked to a friend who has a little Cocker Spaniel who he's starting to do this with. And it might be worth it if you have the time and if you have the energy and if you have the training birds and the friends. Another thing, does that help at all, by the way?
Well, yes. And I think a lot of that is in the strain of dogs or how you've trained them and how close you are with the dogs. You know, this year in South Dakota, the first 2 weeks, I was out there with my old dog who's going to be 9, and I had a 4.5-month-old puppy. Well, by the time the third week rolls around, the puppy was just doing great, and he knew all about the birds and tracking running birds. You know, I can stop the old dog, but at 4.5 months, I wasn't going to try to stop the puppy from tracking and chasing a bird that was going to flush 50 to 100 yards away. But yes, you know, and that's all in just experience of the dog. That, and so the running birds are a little different than the ones that's going to sit there and the dog working at that 20 yard range that you're speaking about, which we've all done a lot of that training, various aspects.
Keeping
them close.
Well, that you know, the tracking puppy's first season, I don't know how bad it would be. I'd want my dog to get so fired up about birds, I probably wouldn't mind as long as I could get him back from 300 yards.
Oh, yeah.
You know, getting him excited about birds is the number one goal for the first season, I think. But
we're thinking alike on that,
yeah.
Scott.
Do you, you know, I can't remember old Satch from way back when he was not old, but he was still Satch. But you know, a lot, again, going back to the tried and true spaniel trainers tricks, you know, they teach, a lot of them call it HUP, whatever you want to call it, sit on the flush. Have you ever thought about doing that?
Yes, but I've decided and said my bread and butter, what I love to do is the wild birds, and whether it's Iowa or South Dakota or Kansas, whatever. And they hit the ground running when you shoot them.
Yeah.
And you know, whatever works, but different thoughts for different folks. But I like for him to be there. If he can catch that bird falling out of the air, that's better than that bird hit the ground running.
I
do some preserve guiding, and there, you know, you got to be careful who you're with and make sure that they know you're not shooting a low bird. And there, if that's what I've done 90% of the time, then I would want to go that way to set for steady and flush and shot. But wild birds, I'm the guy that wants my dog there as fast as he can. And there again, one thought is not better than the other. You know, it's whatever works for the hunter.
Having that discussion right now on Facebook, what is a finished dog? And we haven't even gotten into the flushing breeds yet. But
yeah,
that is a can of worms times five.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, keeping him in range, I think to a degree, it's also, especially in the pointing breeds, I get this question a lot. I think it's genetic. I don't know how much you can do. Now, in a flusher that you want to work really close, the other thing you can do is if you're teaching that quartering, is to teach that dog to work to your front. And one way to do that is basically to make sure you're changing direction frequently, and the dog is kind of motivated to realize that and get back to the front where you are at the moment. I use that trick even on Flick to this day. He'll be out messing around behind me for one reason or another. Usually it's a chipmunk. And I'll just forge ahead in a direction that's exactly the opposite of where he is. And he eventually figures out, hey, I'm seeing his ass end as he's leaving. I better get back up there. So he does to a great degree. And part of that is because he comes out of great lines, and other dogs do too. And maybe they'll figure that out. They want to see your face. And if they're seeing the back of your hat with the catchy logo on it, that's not your face. They're going to probably be motivated to come around and get back in front. You look silly doing it in a small field in short chunks, but it could be a way to ingrain that in your dog as well.
And I hunt some in food plots, and then that's a different story than hunting the quarter section of CRP, you know, for the dog to quarter and stay close. And I'm a believer in those big CRP fields. Follow your dog's nose.
Yeah.
Is better than walking in a straight line. You know.
Yeah. You know, I used to say that on another TV show I used to host many years ago. Once you're in the field, once the tailgate drops, the dog's the master. They know way more about finding birds than we ever will. So let's follow them as long as you can bring him back if you need to. And part of that's obedience, you know?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. You know, if they're still within voice range, you can call them back, or you can whistle them back, or you can use a hand signal. All of those work. And I'll just add you one more thing. If you use hand signals, folks, I learned this the hard way as well. A moving hand signal works way better than a stationary hand signal. And we've all seen them at the field trials, the retriever trials, where they'll blow that long whistle and then they'll put their hand straight up in the air. Well, at a field trial, you'd look silly if you did anything besides that. But in a hunting situation, dogs see moving objects way better than they see stationary objects. So if you can add a little bit of, you know, jazz hands to your signals without being embarrassed about it, it does help a lot.
That movement. And we have talked over the years also, getting that dog to hunt for you instead of the dog just hunting for themselves is very important in the flushing breeds, especially.
Yeah. And you know, if you think about what they want out of a hunt, it's pretty simple. They want to, number one, we hope, be with you, but they also want to find birds. So if they can do both at the same time by finding birds close to you, you got it made. But that means you got to go to places where the birds are going to be close to you.
Oh, yeah. They love feathers in their mouth. That's what they want.
That's exactly right. You know, every bit of a dog training strategy really boils down to getting to fetch.
Yes. Yes.
All right, man. Well, good luck with the puppy. Good luck with Satch. I'm so glad we could talk. Thanks a lot. And I hope you have the rest of the season is better than you expect.
Oh, yes. Here in Kentucky, I'm into the tower retrieving at Tower Shoot. So we get a lot of that. And it said fun for the dogs. As long as they get feathers in their mouth, they're happy as can be.
All right.
Well, hope that Flick keeps getting better and better every day out, Scott.
As long as I don't blow it, he will. Thank you very much, Mark. Good to talk with you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Goodbye.
And that'll do it for calls this time around. We'll do that some more. It was a lot of fun. I sure enjoyed it. But the fun isn't over quite yet. Our This Land Is Your Land segment with a spot to hunt that costs you nothing but boot leather and fuel coming up right after this message from Dogtra. Learn more about all the Dogtra products at dogtra.com. They've got everything in the way of dog training collars, including the Pathfinder GPS unit and my favorite new training collar, the T&B Dual. The reason I like it so much, I don't need to mess around. There's two sets of buttons. I can run two dogs at the same time, or one dog with two collars. Yeah, you know what we're doing when it comes to that, steadiness and retrieving. All of those, 10% off. Just use the code SLUN10. 10% discount and free shipping on anything over $200. It's all at dogtra.com. Tell them I sent you. We are so lucky in the United States of America to have public land that we can just walk on and go hunting. One of my favorite of the United States is just south of me, Nevada. The Silver State, they call it. To me, it's golden for all sorts of reasons. Get yourself a good map of whatever area you are planning to go in over there. Look for all the yellow spots, because most of Nevada is owned by federal agencies, and most of the time that federal agency is the Bureau of Land Management. That's their assigned color on most of the maps. Gamble's Quail near Las Vegas, one of my favorites. It's a desert. They're a desert bird. It is sometimes hard to get out there, but in January, it is one of the nicest places to be. So if you have to spend some time in Vegas like I do, bring your shotgun and bring your dog the next time. Find the water, find the birds. They're seldom more than a mile from a water source. Even in the desert, there are streams and guzzlers, and that's what you're going to look for on your map. There are birds east of Alamo. It's about 100 miles north of Sin City. South of Caliente, that's another 60 miles east from there. So you're going to do some driving in your rental car, but you're going to have a good time in southern Nevada with your home base being Las Vegas. Yeah, cha-ching. You're going to hit the jackpot, but it's a slightly different kind of jackpot. And that land is your land. One quick reminder, ESPAmerica.com, that's where you're going to find all sorts of custom-fitted hearing protection devices, just like I use, in the field and on the range, ESPAmerica.com. And with that, it's time to say goodbye for yet another edition of the Upland Nation podcast. Appreciate your being with us. Appreciate all the phone calls. If you'd like to be on the podcast, you know how to reach me. Wing Shooting USA Facebook page, the Upland Nation Facebook page, scottlindenoutdoors@gmail.com, smoke signals, skywriting. I'll probably even be able to decipher your Morse code. However you want to talk to me, please do. Tell your friends, and if you will do me a big favor, leave a rating or a review at Stitcher or Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Please leave a review and a rating. And if you have something to talk about in terms of helping the podcast become even better, don't hesitate to drop me a note. Until I talk with you next on the Upland Nation podcast, I'll see you on Wing Shooting USA, the TV show, and at our Facebook pages. I hope the rest of your season goes extremely well. Don't forget to take a friend hunting, and I'll see you in the field.